From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. I'm pretty certain most of us did not have measles on our bingo card of things to worry about last year. But as we've seen, this virus seems to be roaring back in our nation, and cases are popping up here in Oregon. Today on the show, we talk with Lane County Medical Director Dr. Patrick Ludke to get the 411 on measles, its causes, its prevention, and its impact on health. Then, in the second part of the show, we talk with a local expert in journalism from the U of O about how the media covers President Trump, especially in light of his recent social media post that has been described by a member of his own party as the most racist thing he's ever seen the president do. We all love a good comeback story, but right now, the story of measles making a comeback in the nation and in Oregon is anything but inspiring. We talk to Lane County's top doctor next. Dr. Patrick Ludke, Senior Medical Director for Lane County. Always great to see you. How are you, sir?
I am just fine. I hope you are as well.
Yeah. Measles. Why don't you remind our audience, what is measles?
Well, first of all, it's a virus, okay. So it's not a fungus or bacteria or parasite, it's a virus, and it's predominantly a respiratory condition, although measles is unique in that it can infect many cells. So you get it from breathing in the virus, you get a respiratory syndrome that looks like any other respiratory syndrome early on, and then the virus spreads and you get that classic measles rash and other issues.
Okay. Why is it bad?
Well, it's a good question, and once in a while in public health, we get accused of being a fear-mongerer, and we don't want to scare people.
Understand.
In 2024, in the United States, 40% of the measles cases were hospitalized. That tells you something.
Yeah.
You know, we have millions of colds that every year, and could you imagine if 40% of the colds were hospitalized? So it can be a bad enough virus that a fair number of people are hospitalized.
Okay.
In 2025, we don't have the complete data yet, but it was around half of that. So 40% is pretty high historically for hospitalization. Yeah. But still, 10, 15, 20% of people get hospitalized, so it can cause severe disease.
And I would imagine, as we've often talked about, certain vulnerable populations are more at risk, the young, the very old, that sort of a thing?
And the immunocompromised.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
And, you know, it's hard to know how many people in this country are immunocompromised, but it seems like a month doesn't go by where we have some new medication that helps people with lupus or rheumatoid arthritis or something, and it tamps down their immune system so they're not attacking their own cells. But, of course, that makes them immunocompromised as well. So we have somewhere between 3 and 6% of the population in the United States that are immunocompromised, and they can be overwhelmed by measles.
Okay. Measles, I'll be honest, it's not something I think many people think about, but it's been in the news this last year or so in that there have been outbreaks. And I think Texas was a place where we first saw media reports on it, and now we've seen it crop up in Oregon. How concerned are you about measles and the spread of it here in Lane County?
Well, I have a continuum of concern,
that's fair enough, fair enough.
So I'm always concerned about people who are immunocompromised,
sure.
People who are at high risk. Again, there's a small percentage of the population that is. But if you read the tea leaves, if you look at what's been happening in other countries as vaccine rates have dropped, we see the return of measles. We see the return of other conditions that we thought were pretty much eliminated. And I've been telling our clinical community over the last year and a half to look north of us, look to Canada. We had 1,500 measles cases last year in the United States. Canada had over 5,000. We're almost 10 times their population.
Wow.
Their vaccine rate for measles is significantly lower than ours.
Okay.
Is that what America's going to look like in 5 to 10 years? If our vaccine rates continue to be low, we're going to have thousands, tens of thousands of cases.
Okay.
It's possible.
Yeah. How effective is a measles vaccine?
Oh, it's one of our best routine vaccines.
Okay.
So two doses and 97% of people get immunity. We think they're immune for life. Now, we only recommended two doses in 1989. So we don't have 100 years of data.
Okay.
But, you know, we have 36 years of data, and we occasionally do what we call serological surveys to see if the antibody levels are still high enough to protect. It's probably producing immunity for life. So great vaccine. You know, wouldn't it be great if the flu vaccine, you got two doses and you were done for life?
Very much so.
It would. We wouldn't have to get a new vaccine every year as the virus mutates, but mm-hmm. it's a great vaccine, the measles vaccine.
So if you're in your 50s or 60s or older, and you had the vaccine when you were a kid, should you check with your doctor? Is there a way, like you said, to be able to say, yeah, I'm still protected? Should you just assume I'm good?
Well, here we go to subgroups again, Michael.
Okay.
So everybody in healthcare should have two doses.
Okay.
Okay. People who are born before 1989, when we went from a single dose recommendation to two doses, they should check with their provider. And see if they need a second dose. Some people will, like I said, especially healthcare workers. But check with your provider. If you don't have a provider, keep trying to get one. Mm-hmm. I know it's tough in medicine these days, mm-hmm. but contact one of the clinics that are readily available for people without a provider, without insurance, Whitebird, Volunteers in Medicine, et cetera.
Okay. Is there a seasonality to measles?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's endemic on planet Earth, which means it's present everywhere all the time in specific areas. And it's spread respiratorily. So when people are indoors, mm-hmm. sharing air, breathing the same air, that's when they're at higher risk. So if you remember last year, when did it erupt in Texas? January.
Okay.
And what's going on in South Carolina right now? Late fall into early winter, huge outbreak in South Carolina of measles right now. They're approaching 1,000 cases in South Carolina. So it's when people get close together and share air.
Okay. There's been a lot recently since COVID, let's be honest, a lot of skepticism about vaccines and even outright hostility. And I'm not going to ask you to weigh in on the politics of it all, but we seem to be a country that is at war with itself over vaccines and its efficacy. Seeing measles on the uptick, is that a direct result of just not enough people getting the vaccine?
Well, it absolutely is. Again, it's on planet Earth in multiple places. And when we became a measles elimination country in the year 2000, the United States did. That didn't mean we had zero measles. It means we didn't have local measles.
Okay.
It means that people who were not protected, they chose not to be vaccinated, or they were immunocompromised and they couldn't make their immunity to it. They went overseas, they got exposed somewhere else, and then they brought it back here. So we had, a few hundred imported cases every year in the United States, but they were imported.
Okay.
So now we have local transmission. Almost all the cases are in people who didn't travel. So it's local United States cases, well over 90% of the cases last year. So it's a challenge, and we are going to endure this until we increase our vaccine rates.
Okay. Let me reintroduce you to the audience, talking to Dr. Patrick Ludke of Lane County, the senior medical officer. During COVID, we got so used to wearing masks. And if people are concerned, maybe they might be older like me and they're not sure if the vaccine is still with them, is masking still a good idea? Does that help stop the spread of measles?
Well, it can help, but it's not going to be sufficient.
Okay.
So there are certain agents that float in the air for a long period of time. Tuberculosis is one of them. Measles is one of them.
Okay.
You were just talking about COVID. Mm-hmm. COVID is typically a larger droplet organism. So that's why we had that 6 feet distancing rule.
Sure.
It's not completely. You can still have smaller droplets that are in the air for mm-hmm. a longer period of time. But measles can float in the air for a while. So if this answers the question, why when there's a measles case, does the health department come to people like you, come to the media and say, if you were at restaurant A mm-hmm. during this 2-hour time frame, you may have been exposed to measles because it can float in the air for 2 hours.
Okay. And if someone like myself getting advice from you says, hey, there's a possible outbreak there, what should people do? And how easy is it to detect in the body that, oh, yes, you're positive for measles?
Well, most people who are naive to measles, meaning that they are not immune, mm-hmm. they'll be very sick with measles. This is not something where you just think, maybe I'm going to have a cold tomorrow.
Oh, I see.
People who've never been vaccinated get exposed to measles and they get it. They get 103, 104, 105 fever.
Oh, wow.
Within a week or so, they start to get a rash. They're miserable. And again, 20, 30% of them can be hospitalized. So it's a miserable thing.
Yeah.
But we have a pretty high vaccination rate mm-hmm. In Lane County and in our region. So depending upon which county, which community you're looking at, it might be 80%, 90%, 95%, depending on the population you're looking at. So we're not going to see thousands of cases of measles in our region. We're not.
Okay.
But we might see some really disruptive outbreaks, a dozen or two or three, four cases. That would be disruptive and a real problem.
Okay. And I would imagine healthcare workers would be at risk because they might be coming into contact with this. Are there other types of groups that might be more adversely impacted by measles or more exposed to it than perhaps the general population?
So exposure, again, respiratory predominantly, and anyone who gets breathed on. So people in what we call congregate settings.
Okay.
So jails and prisons, long-term care facilities, again, healthcare as well. They're breathing the same air maybe for days on end, right? Mm. And those people are continually exposed. So if you have one case introduced into that facility, that air is contaminated for an extended period of time until the person recovers.
Got it. In addition to this, how is our flu season doing?
Well, unfortunately, flu right now is getting close to the peak.
Okay.
We can never accurately predict when the peak will be.
Sure.
But we're not in a good place right now for influenza. And if you were a betting person, you'd say, oh, probably in the month of February, we will peak. There's always a question, will there be a second peak after this peak drops off for a while? That happened last year.
Mm-hmm.
We had a peak. 6 to 8 weeks later, we had another peak. So we can't predict if that's going to happen. The influenza virus does what it wants to do. But we're in a place right now where we have a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm.
The hospitals are not overwhelmed, but they're seeing, you know, lots of inpatients because there's a lot of influenza out there.
Doctor, my last question for you is this. The CDC made a big announcement about basically retreating from vaccine guidance. And I just wanted to get your ideas on concerns about that, about changing vaccine guidance and how that might percolate down to a place like Lane County.
Oh, boy, that's a tough question. I would say a couple things. First of all, I would hope that our vaccine recommendations are based upon the science. Science isn't perfect. It is a system of getting to a truth. Science, by definition, is often changing because we get new technologies, we have new research studies, we use that data to hone our recommendations.
Okay.
It's a pity that some recommendations are being based on politics now.
Hmm.
I think that's a pity. Now, the recommendations are different than any imposed rules, et cetera. That's more political.
Okay.
Many vaccines, especially if they're given out by the government, are the people's money. The people should have a vote on this. The people should be able to say, I want to do this, I want to do that, or can I at least be heard?
Good enough. He's Dr. Patrick Ludke, the Senior Medical Officer for Lane County. Always great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Never easy, Michael, but always a pleasure.
Tim Gleason is a journalism professor emeritus at the U of O and joins me now to explain how reporters cover a president who seeks to shock and goad the press. Tim Gleason, professor emeritus for the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communications. Tim, it's always great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me, Michael.
Recently, the president forwarded a meme. He didn't generate it, but he forwarded it. And it generated a lot of publicity for people who may not know. It was a meme based on The Lion King. And towards the end, there was this horrible image of the Obamas sort of juxtapose their faces over apes. And so a lot of people took obvious issue with it. And my question for you is this. You know, a lot of the media certainly called the meme racist. And my question for you is, if the president sends something that's racist, what are the rules of engagement for journalists saying, oh, therefore, that person who sent that meme must also be racist?
Well, I think it's a pretty complicated question.
Mm-hmm.
on a number of different levels. But let me start with, before getting into the details of the specific question.
Okay.
Let me start with a basic principle of storytelling and journalism, which is that you tell stories, you don't show, you show, you don't tell.
Okay.
So if you're showing and not telling, then in this instance, what you do is you say, here's what was done.
Okay.
It was racist. Maybe you say that.
Okay.
Or maybe you don't. Maybe you just say, here's what the president did, and leave it to the reader or the viewer, the listener, to determine what he or she thinks of that particular act.
Okay.
Now, 20 years ago, that would have been pretty much the standard journalistic response. We're going to tell you what happened and leave it entirely up to you to determine what you think of it.
Okay.
That's changing.
Okay.
And it's changing to a significant degree because of having to deal with the unprecedented behavior of the president during the Trump administrations.
Yeah, and kind of what, jumping off on that, this wasn't necessarily an isolated incident. Now, many people may argue that certain things rise to certain levels and certain things don't, but obviously there's been kind of a pattern of if, and maybe I'm being too generous here, but a pattern of inappropriate language or forwarding on his social media network, forwarding memes that are certainly inappropriate. When you have a lot of action from a powerful figure like the president, does a line get crossed? Is there a line where the consensus in the media is, okay, now we can say X?
Well, I think what you're seeing, and we've been seeing a lot of this in the last couple of days especially, I mean, the number of news organizations that have listed the long litany of instances where Trump has engaged in behavior or made statements that many would consider racist.
Hmm.
And they've made that point. They've said this is out there. I mean, here it is. We can go back to Trump long before he became a candidate for presidency, you know, back to his early days in the housing industry.
Mm-hmm.
And we can find instances where he engaged in behaviors that many believe to be racist.
Okay.
And the use of the actual term racist is complicated because the definition of racist is complicated. I mean, you have really kind of an ongoing debate in discussion about, well, is it in a narrow definition of racist would be someone who does something because they hate people of another race.
Sure.
All right. That's a very narrow definition of racism. At the other end of the spectrum, you have structural racism. I mean, whether the person intended it to be racist or not, the behavior is allowed, and the structure that allows it is in and of itself a racist structure.
I see.
So where does the journalist come down on that? When I was teaching, mm-hmm. I would throw out a term like, okay, what's it mean to be a racist? Are you racist if you engage in one act that is considered racism? Are you racist when you do two acts?
Hmm.
Or does it take 10? Where's the line?
Yeah.
And since that line is hard to draw, my advice would always be, don't use terms you can't define.
I see. Huh, interesting. A term I think we can define is lying. And I know many people are sort of operate under the mindset of, well, all politicians lie. But I want to perhaps, you know, again, on sort of the same exercise we just went through. It seems to me that in Trump's first term, there was a real reticence to say, oh, he lied right there. A lot of times they would say things like, oh, he misstated the fact, or he, you know, used obfuscation or something like that. But specific to the 2020 election, he has claimed again and again and continues to that he won that election. And I'm seeing a lot of media saying, oh, that's, you know, Trump lies about the 2020 election. Is there a different calculation with regard to that act of lying and saying, no, that's a lie versus that's a misstatement of fact?
Well, I think in the instance of the 2020 election, the question is, what does the individual know and what is their intent?
Okay.
I mean, if you're lying, you are intending to deceive people.
Okay.
And so in order to be deceiving people, you have to actually know that what you're saying is false.
Okay.
And the argument that, and you're absolutely right, that news organizations have become much more, I know that they're comfortable, but much more willing to say that's a lie.
Okay.
And they're saying it's a lie because the evidence is so strong on the other side of that statement. You know, you have over 20 court decisions where the court said, no, there wasn't you know, the vote was solid.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have, and this has been an important part in a number of the stories, you have evidence from within the White House of counselors to President Trump who told him that there was no evidence of fraud in the election. And so if you have all that evidence on the side of here are the facts, and we know that the president knows those facts, either he's lying,
mm-hmm.
or he has more serious mental problems.
Okay. That's a good point. That's a good point. Let me reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking to Professor Emeritus Tim Gleason from the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communications. Tim, my last question for you, and this is a bit of a turn here, but just recently, you know, the Washington Post made a major announcement about massive layoffs, and then their executive editor stepped away, left. Can a publication like the Washington Post, can it fail and die, in your opinion?
It's frightening to say, but yes.
Okay.
And I think if you look at what's happened to the Washington Post over the last 2 years, as it has diminished itself, and is now at a point where the people who work there are seriously concerned about, will there be something called the Washington Post? I suppose there will be.
Hmm.
But will it be the Washington Post that we've known, you know, since the 1960s? I mean, you've got to remember the Washington Post for a long time was a pretty mediocre regional newspaper.
Okay.
But then it became
then
it became a great newspaper.
Yeah.
And it has been a great newspaper for decades
mm-hmm.
now. Given what's happened in the last 2 weeks, it can't continue to be a great newspaper. And that is a tragedy for all of us in a democracy.
Indeed, indeed. Tim, I always appreciate your insights. Professor Emeritus Tim Gleason from the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communications, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. Enjoyed it.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Tomorrow on the show, we talk about efforts at the state legislature to build a firewall between the massive cuts from the federal government and Oregon. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.